Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Mads. Coming up on the program today, South Africa is through to the World Cup knockouts, but what does this mean for the players, the brand, and the business of football? As Bafana go through, how TikTok, streaming, and social media are changing the way football fans watch the beautiful game. President Ramaphosa brings back budget brain Michael Sachs. Is this the economic reset that business has been waiting for? And the latest C-suite survey in South Africa says resilience is no longer enough for business leaders. It's Thursday, the 25th of June. Now, I don't need to tell you, it is one of the biggest nights in South African football history. Bafana Bafana's victory over South Korea, securing a place in the knockout stages of the FIFA World Cup for the very first time, I think reigniting belief and putting South African football back on the global stage. But beyond the result itself lies a bigger story about confidence, opportunity, and what playing on football's biggest stage can do for a player's career and commercial value. I want to talk now to Mark Simaponyane, former Bafana Bafana striker and respected football analyst and commentator. Mark, a very warm welcome to you. An exhausting night for most South Africans. Where do you think this victory ranks in the history of South African football?
Yeah, I think this is going to say a lot about South Africa and about the image of South African football. And it was very interesting when I was listening to the commentators. They were talking about the youngsters that expressed themselves so well on the pitch that I'm sure the scouts, as they were saying, I'm sure the scouts are just sharpening their pencils and are just getting for their signatures.
What do you think this does to South Africa's broader football image? And let's be honest, it's been under some degree of difficulty in recent years.
It has been. And we all can't ignore the fact that even the stories of the president in the courts does not really help the game. But other than that, it becomes one of those where locally you realize that there's now the sort of a protest after protest and scandal after scandal. And you think, can we get it right? Can just somebody get promoted without some people questioning the illegality of certain players who were improperly registered or something? And this season it went so well, if you have to be honest. And I was looking forward to such, and it never happened. And this is now the fruits of that, because it shows that that confidence gets to be built even further to the dizzy heights, to the World Cup level.
You talk about that confidence being built further. Let's talk about the psychological side briefly. Do moments like this, Mark, permanently change the mindset, do you think, of a national team? Or, as I guess you might say, the real test is still to come on Sunday?
It does change permanently. I'll tell you why. Because what we are celebrating is something that has never happened. It's a milestone. So you cannot now diffuse it by saying, Sunday, we'll see what's going to happen against Canada. It is something that has never happened. But because it is unprecedented, we have to just say, let's celebrate it and say, this is what we can do. Even if we lose against Canada, we look back into the next World Cup and say, yes, we have qualified before, we can qualify, then we will expect nothing less than qualification from the next group.
From a management and leadership perspective, how much credit at this point do you think belongs to the coaching staff for transforming a team that, let's be honest, few people expected to reach this stage?
A lot has to be credited to the coaching staff. And I'll tell you why, Jeremy, because these are the same people that gets a stick when the team is not performing. I remember the opening match. I was not even having hope at all. after the performance of running around like headless chickens and chasing shadows, and could not even construct the sentence, let alone a move, you know? And I thought, this is just not going to happen. And then they started looking solid in the second game, and I remember I was very impressed with the second half of the second game. And how's that? The last game, where it matters most, they continued where they left off.
Do you think?
And by the way, Jeremy, on that fact, sorry, is that now the coaching staff shows that they are not resolute and saying this is my way or your way, but they just say we prepare to listen, we prepare to agree with you whether what needs to change or what did not to change, and a lot has changed. They didn't stick to their guns and say, no, Jeremy will play.
Yep.
You know, they'll just say, he did not perform, let's try others. And that is how a team works. That is why it's called a squad. And as a squad, you win tournaments. As individuals, you win games.
Let's talk a little bit about player economics, if we can. Do you think a situation like this changes a player's brand overnight in terms of sponsorship, endorsement, and recognition? And is there a danger maybe that success at this point accelerates the departure of South Africa's better talent to overseas clubs?
Yeah, not danger as such, but let's talk about the brand. The brand, yes, will change. A lot of players, when you look at the tournament like this, you always look at the world scouts looking at them. And I'm looking at a few youngsters like Diamande of Ivory Coast. I mean, here's a youngster that was dominating in the AFCON, and now in the World Cup, he's still hugging that line and doing wonders. And a lot more. I mean, Messi, we know him. But his value will go up because obviously the association that he has will grow and will always be sort of enhanced by his performance. But everyone else wants to be the best. You know, the best thing about enhancement of the brand is you look at all the top stars or expected to perform. And I'm so impressed by this World Cup for that reason. You look at all those top stars or expected stars to perform. They have delivered so far, I must admit. I mean, your Ronaldos, your Mbappes, your Haaland, Messi, you name them, Salah, they've all scored. And you think, wow, this is what the tournament is all about. And the sponsors will not be embarrassed to say, now you're backing a dead horse here.
Marx, beyond the pitch itself, beyond the players, what does a run like this do, you think, for South African football commercially? Might it attract more sponsors, bigger audiences, maybe even greater investment?
Yes, and I'm saying yes, in an emphatic yes, because then when we come to sponsors and say, this is a little academy that I'm running, this is a little corner where I'm identifying talent, and this is what I would like to do. They don't say, oh, no, don't tell me about Bafana Bafana, don't tell me about soccer, it goes nowhere. You know, they would listen and say, let's give it a try. I mean, a sensible boardroom will just sit there and say, okay, we're not going to give them X amount, but we can try them out at a certain amount and see how far we can go. And surprise, surprise, they could grow with the development, and that development become a product that really is someone that was or that money was pumped on and becomes one of those greatest names. You know what happened in the past. We're not even doing this for the first time. Benny McCarthy was known worldwide, you know, because of the feats that he performed in a Champions League against Manchester United, scoring goals, you know. And that also says, where is this man from? From South Africa. So we say we have many of such. And by the way, there's some one or two things that South Africans don't know. There's a youngster, 9-year-old, who signed by Roma in Italy at that age of nine. They've given him a 7-year, in fact, a 9-year contract. I mean, this youngster, what's going to happen to his confidence, Jeremy, when it comes to the next two World Cups? His confidence will be that high, and he will literally be the guy that might be even dominating in the Bafana Bafana team.
Thank you so much indeed for that insight and analysis, Marx Maponyane.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The World Cup may still be watched on the big screen, but the modern football audience is no longer sitting quietly in one place for 90 minutes. Fans are checking X for team news. They're watching TikTok analysis. They're arguing in WhatsApp groups. They're following creators, streaming clips, and reacting in real time across multiple platforms. Now, the insights company Reach Africa says this changes the advertising opportunity completely. Now, obviously, the live broadcast still matters, but the real commercial action may be around what is happening around the match and not only during it. He's been on the program with us before, and welcome back to sales director Leslie Adams. Leslie, welcome. Are brands still buying World Cup audiences if people only watch one screen? Can't be the case.
Look, it's the FIFA World Cup remains the most commercialized global tournament ever. And the audience size is immense. Every time we have a FIFA World Cup, we see this massive comparison, you know, the NFL versus the NFL 100 million viewers versus the billion viewers that you see across any particular game of the FIFA World Cup. Live football still holds its own, but the audience have moved from one screen to multiple screens, and that's where it becomes really interesting, and how brands can build communities playing in multiple spaces to really engage with them.
Let's talk about those communities in just a moment, but as far as the traditional television broadcast is concerned, do you think it has lost or is losing control of the conversation incrementally?
It's a great question, Jeremy, because I think the FIFA World Cup 2026 has actually weakened the monopoly that broadcast has held over global sporting events, specifically on football in this particular case. Normally, we are so accustomed to all large sort of global events being on broadcasters only. The FIFA World Cup, specifically in Africa, is now on DSTV MultiChoice, on SABC Plus, on SABC from a broadcast and streaming perspective, but also on Sporty TV, which now engages in a different streaming app entirely. TikTok and YouTube also stream parts of the game as well as having full access to highlights. So for the consumer out there, and especially for the younger consumer who's not necessarily a broadcast consumer, the connected world is now opened up with apps, streaming apps, communication apps, social apps, all now participating in what is now this broadcasting and conversation around the great game.
And Leslie, it's confusing and it's exhausting, because if fans are everywhere at once at the same time, how does a brand avoid simply adding to the noise?
It's about being intentional and meaningful in terms of how you participate in different environments. So I think the idea around how we engage with audiences is less about one-way communication. It's now very much a two-way conversation. You know, we've seen the evolution of, you know, platforms like X going from a conversation platform and to a sort of customer complaints part of how businesses interact in that space. Suddenly, WhatsApp groups are now heated debates for sporting games, and a way for brands to participate meaningfully in that space is to sort of hold a position that's meaningful, and possibly in some cases even, you know, contrary to the sort of following the trend. What's really interesting, though, is that now engaging with consumers can be one-to-one, can be personal, can be intentional, and not just sort of, let's put it on TV and hope it lands. It's now about, let's put it in the spaces where we can have conversations, engage meaningfully, and then influence behavior.
But you can't contrive that authenticity or intentionality that you refer to, can you?
No, not at all. Authenticity really is the way of the future. And because creators play such a big role in how we're doing this thing, and creators as a term has really evolved, right? Some of the biggest television shows and sports shows are now hosted by football pundits who sit and have their own YouTube show or own social media show. We're seeing watch parties being hosted by Trevor Noah, for example, where hundreds of thousands of people tune in to watch the game with like-minded fans, but engage in a meaningful way where, again, you might have opposing views or opposing rivalries, but engage authentically. And this is where brands can really play an interesting role. And if you look at even some of the bigger brands who are in broadcast, who are on social, like Adidas, who've really played an interesting role in terms of what particular narrative they are pushing as a brand and how it works with driving the fan narrative as well as the professional narrative. That becomes a really holistic way of communicating what your brand stands for in an authentic way that's meaningful to the consumer.
Explain to me why communities then are so important to brands right now.
Look, communities is the last stronghold of word of mouth, the last recommendation. My community will influence my ultimate wallet spend, which brand I will engage with, and how I'll view that brand is now viewed not only through my eyes as an individual, but through my community's eyes that I engage with on a regular basis. It's the last stronghold where we can really influence perception, the overall interest and demand, and ultimately the size of spend within that space, sort of spend basket. Communities is this next space, because in this world where we are so digitized, where we are so alone, it's the one place where we look for meaning is through our community. And this is where brands will play a meaningful role by supporting that and encouraging that.
Led by influencers. And do you think, Leslie, this particular cohort is now competing directly with sports journalists and broadcasters?
Absolutely. I mean, even the term, I think, influencing creator is quite narrow in this context. We see like legends of the game in football having their own shows, driving their own sort of narratives, engaging with fans in different ways. And because you have that direct access to these sort of mega personalities, it now becomes influence, yes, because you're drawn to the personality, but also because you now have a way to relate in a way that's meaningful, that moves the conversation forward. That drives influence ultimately, because we're now moving into a space where, you know, before the medium mattered. So if it was on TV, the medium drove the narrative. Whereas now it's no longer that, it's been completely flipped, where it's driven specifically by the personality, and then the medium itself becomes second, because the consumer, or especially the younger consumer, maybe on their phone, maybe on a tablet, maybe on a connected TV, or maybe watching traditional broadcast. But ultimately, it's that they're following the personality, not the medium itself.
So a couple of years ago, the most valuable moments of a football match would have been within the 90 minutes. That's no longer the case, right?
Absolutely. The micro moments, the highlights, the conversations and discussions happen in and around the match itself. So suddenly, you know, things like, you know, a VAR decision where a referee goes to the side of the field and that delay of 2 minutes, that becomes a whole cohort of conversation in different platforms, different social media platforms, as well as WhatsApp, X, and others. And that great debate, that swaying and engagement of brands, that's the stuff that brands are really after. Meaningful, emotional, invested debate.
So just a final question, and let me flip the paradigm if I can. What should a brand not do if it wants to reach football fans during this World Cup tournament?
Not do. I think the one thing I will say is, the one thing I would say and advise brands is to remain open-minded. Meet the customer where the customer is. Engage with them where they are, as opposed to hoping they find their way to where your brand is. It's very much, you have to be a lot more intentional about where you show up. This global event, which was previously monopolized by broadcasters, has completely been dissipated and now lives on YouTube, lives on TikTok, lives on X, lives in your WhatsApp messages, lives on different streaming platforms, which means the audience you're trying to find is so much more fragmented. And because of that, you've got to find where you can engage authentically. And that's not everywhere for every brand, but it may not always be broadcast television.
Leslie Adams, as always, I appreciate the valuable insight from Reach Africa. Thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
President Ramaphosa has turned to one of the architects of South Africa's post-apartheid budgets, appointing former National Treasury Budget Chief Michael Sacks as his economic advisor. Now, the move has been welcomed by and large by business as a signal that fiscal discipline and economic reform may once again be moving closer to the center of government. But is this appointment going to change the trajectory of the economy at all, or is delivery, as I imagine, the real test still? Let's get some response to this. I'm in conversation now with Martin Kingston from Business for South Africa. Martin, a very warm welcome. So what's the single biggest signal then that the president is sending by appointing Michael Sacks?
Well, Jeremy, Michael is very well known to the business community, well known to the country at large, and indeed the investment community. He did a superb job when he was in National Treasury, when he was responsible for the budget. And I think many of us have missed him when he left. And we welcome his return to play a critical role by the president's side as his economic advisor. My view is that he has an absolutely comprehensive and incisive understanding of the challenges facing the country and of the solutions that need to be brought to bear. And he'll no doubt be able to use his authority, given his proximity to the president and the influence that he'll be able to bring to bear with regards to economic policy in the months ahead. And as you said, it's not just a question of policy, it's also a question of delivery. We've already engaged with Michael about the work that we're doing in partnership with government, and we want to accelerate that work. And I would like to hope that he is very much focused on many of the same interventions.
So is it simply good politics, or maybe does it suggest, as I alluded to, a shift in some way or another in economic thinking inside government?
Well, I think it's a progression rather than a shift. I think that there is already a recognition as to the need for both balancing our budget, and I think the Minister of Finance has been very clear and consistent, as has the Director General, but also the implementation of structural reform and playing to our competitive strengths. We haven't been doing that as a country, making sure that the constraints on real inclusive growth are addressed. And Michael, in my opinion and in my experience, understands all of that, living, as I said, within the constraints. And that means, inter alia, mobilizing the resources and the capacity of the private sector wherever and whenever possible.
Do you think the appointment strengthens the hand of reformers inside government, Martin, or do they still remain outnumbered?
No, I think that our own experience over the past 3 years of the economic partnership that you have discussed with me before has demonstrated that there is a move towards a reform which is embraced by many, if not all, of those in Parliament and government. And indeed, Michael's appointment is, I think, a testimony to the fact that that needs to be both bolstered and reinforced, but also accelerated. I don't think that it's because there are laggards in the system. I think it's because there are capacity constraints. And as we know, the President hasn't had an economic advisor by his side since Trudy Macaya left, I suppose, some 3 years ago. So it's certainly absolutely timely and necessary, but I don't think that it signals anything other than an acceleration and a deepening of the commitment to the reform that you were talking about.
Realistically, though, how much influence can an advisor really have if difficult political decisions still rest with Cabinet?
Oh, I think advisors have very significant influence. We've seen that already with Dr. Alistair Raters, who's played a critical role not only on bilateral arrangements between South Africa and the US, which we've talked about before, but also in the mobilization of investment capital and unblocking critical constraints in the system. I think that they have the ability, the flexibility, and in some respects, the autonomy to be able to move effortlessly. And when they are people who are highly regarded, as Michael Sachs is, who's had considerable access to all of the key decision makers, both in cabinet and indeed within the administration, and is well known to the president and the presidency, I think that we shouldn't underestimate their influence and their ability to secure critical outcomes.
So where does he start? Is it fixing public finances, driving investment, or accelerating reforms?
Well, I would like to hope that it's certainly in reinforcing public finances. I mean, we've seen only today the statement that the Minister of Finance has made with respect to the city of Johannesburg. It's an absolute crisis in front of us that needs to be addressed. And municipal financial reform must be at the top of any agenda headed by Johannesburg if we resolve that issue. And I think business has been very clear about its willingness to come to the party in the right circumstances. That obviously must be one. I think the second is obviously the parlous state that we've had with respect to state-owned enterprises and municipalities more generally. I have no doubt that that'll be a focus of his attention, working closely not only with National Treasury but also with the other arms of government to address those constraints. And then, as you said, obviously the acceleration of structural reform and facilitating many of the interventions we're already beginning to look at as business with government.
And no doubt ratings agencies are going to welcome this.
There's no doubt. We've already seen, of course, a very positive response from all of the rating agencies as to the progress we're making. I think that they all acknowledge it's not fast enough and not broad enough. But somebody like Michael coming to the party will undoubtedly, again, encourage them that progress will be accelerated and broadened. And I think that we will see over time, hopefully, if we maintain the trajectory, improved responses from the rating agencies going forwards.
Do you think that one of the reasons why this appointment has been made is the president is also trying to secure some sort of legacy before he goes?
Well, I would hope that whether it's the president or his successor, that the trajectory we're on is maintained. There's no doubt deepening the reforms that are already underway and the approach, in particular the fiscal policy that is in place, will be a legacy of President Ramaphosa when he steps down ultimately as president of the country. But I think that we need to embed that in the cabinet more broadly and indeed in the way in which we approach our macroeconomic policy as a country. And if we're able to do that in the coming year or two. That will indeed be one of the legacies that President Ramaphosa can leave.
And Martin, to finish with the old trope, you can't manage it unless you measure it. What sort of changes should investors and business expect over the next year or so if this appointment is to be judged a success?
Well, as you know, and we've discussed before, Jeremy, we do need to measure it, and we need to do so on a regular, transparent basis. I think if we're able to demonstrate that there is progressive increase in GDP, and it's unfortunately perilously low at the moment, if we're able to address unemployment, if we're able to increase the level of fixed investment, those will all be metrics that will be testimony to what we've been talking about.
Martin Kingston, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Now, global executives say they are optimistic, but the numbers, I think, tell a more complicated and nuanced story. The latest Forbes Mazars C-suite barometer shows something in the region of 92% of leaders saying they're confident about company growth, yet revenue expectations have fallen to their lowest level since 2021. Economic uncertainty, competition, political instability, all the top barriers. And while artificial intelligence and adaptability dominate investment plans. Let's put all of that on the table. I'm joined now by Sebastian Duplass, who is clients and markets partner at Forbes Mazars. Sebastian, welcome to you. Are executives then genuinely confident, or are they being forced to sound more confident than they actually are?
Hi, Jeremy. So the leaders globally in the world are more confident, which is surprising when we look at the result from our study, because as you say, the world today has never been so uncertain. It started from the COVID crisis, then we had the war in Russia and Ukraine, then we had the Middle East with Hormuz Strait, then I would say we have Donald Trump that is also causing a few issues worldwide. But what the companies are realizing is that now this uncertainty is becoming a new norm. So they have to adapt, and because they have looked at ways to adapt and not waiting anymore for stability, they are more confident. And there are a few topics on which they are working, and they did review their strategy that include technology transformation, that include international expansion, that include relooking at their business model, new product, new market, supply chain, and as well including the talents. And what should do the staff that they have today in the coming months or years.
And that being forced to adapt and develop this thicker skin, I guess, explains the 92% optimism when revenue expectations are at their weakest in 5 years.
So the revenue expectation is at the weakest, but I would like to notice that 90% globally of the leaders are expecting the revenue to increase in 2026. And 93% of the leaders that we have interviewed in Africa are expected to increase. So if we, it was more than that in the last 2-3 years, but we are still at more than 90%. So we also look need to put all the numbers one after one. There are different ways and different reasons for which they are quite positive and optimistic on increasing the revenues. I gave you a few team that I've put earlier, but I think what we have noticed in that study is all the work that is done by the leaders at board level, at C-suite, to reorganize their business and to be more competitive. For example, what we see at Forbes Mazars with our clients that are international groups in Africa, and we work with some of the largest groups in Africa, we see more and more companies that are externalizing their accounting, their internal control functions, or they keep it internally, but they will choose to have delivery centers in some countries in order to control the quality, in order to have less employees, and also in order to be more efficient in terms of new technologies they will implement, AI, so to have delivery centers. And this is something we see more and more, and where companies are going at the moment, especially in Africa.
Sebastian, if uncertainty, as you're suggesting, is permanent or at least semi-permanent, it becomes a lot more difficult for companies, does it not, for them to plan properly?
So I think the planning is different. So in the past, you knew that inflation will be at a certain rate. You knew that you will be able to order for a certain supplier at a certain price. Today, they are looking at different ways to do the operations. I give one example on the supply chain where a company in the past was looking at what is the cheapest price to import certain goods, raw materials. Today, they are looking at how can they receive a supply in a certain time. Obviously, there will be price differences, but these price differences can be covered by using better some digital tools. What we see today and what we didn't see 3 years ago is a change in the AI and digital. So I know you have a lot of discussions with people on this topic, so I won't go deeper. But what is important to see is a change at board level strategy, where 2 years ago, we were using words such as we experiment, it is optional, this is a pilot, I want my team to try. Where today, we are asking the team to show us a return on investment, a strategy. We are talking about execution. So 2026 is a year where AI and digital advisory is digital, sorry, transformation is not anymore an option, but it is a must do. We are measured on it. And this is a way to cover some price differences in, to come back to my example, purchasing price and uncertainty coming from this. Of course, I'm thinking at the moment of Hormuz Straits, where some prices have increased and we all see it. But some companies are able to manage that price differences.
Do you think companies are using technology then to grow or mainly to cut costs and to protect margin?
So there are different motivations for using technology and AI in particular. 49% of the leaders are saying they're using it for better decision making, 45% for competitive advantage, and 43%, it's a discussion we just had now, for operational optimization. So there are different motivations, but some of them are directly expecting, yes, to have more profitability revenue. I'm thinking about the one using it for client experience, using it for be more efficient, you know, when you ship goods, how many parcels can you put in a truck and how to organize it. But some others are using it to reorganize their business for a better quality of product. And it's not directly to sell better, but at the end, every business, everything they do is at the end for a better revenue, obviously, and better profit.
And Sebastian, just a quick answer as we end this conversation. As far as South African business is concerned, do you think it's well placed for the next global rebound, or do you think we might be overstating our resilience?
Now, I think the resilience is excellent. When we speak about the world that is uncertain, the world is discovering since COVID that we cannot have a stable political and supply chain and other topic. In Africa, it's been many, many years that we are living like this. Energy insecurity, logistic disruption, political uncertainty, inflation. So we are already used to it. We already prepared ourselves. Look at how many people already are not counting on municipalities for energy, for water. So we were more prepared. That's the reason why we are less I'm looking for my word in English, sorry, I won't find it, but we are less impacted by this uncertainty today in Africa. We are more optimistic and we are looking more at developing our businesses inside Africa because difficulty is less an issue for us than global companies. And my conclusion word is we also have to be careful not to be too optimistic because we have big challenges in Africa in terms of education, in terms of infrastructure, logistics, in terms of corruption, governance. And we must work together on these topics. I'm talking about private sector in order to transform opportunities into a return for all the companies on the continent.
And your English, Sebastian, is a lot better than my French. Thank you very much indeed, Sebastian Duplass, who is Clients and Markets Partner at Forbes Mazars South Africa. Appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.